So let's just take a moment, then we'll have satsang.
Sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinavaditamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
I was just looking back in my notes and I had a question once upon a time, but I'd love to hear it again. This term, dvija, twice born?
Oh, yeah.
Dvija, what's the significance of that? Can you say something around that?
Swamiji could probably say a lot more, but... I mean, he would really be a dvija. The ja of dvija comes from jan, janja, to be born, to like. So just the one who is born. It's a verbal ending, and dvi means two. So the word itself means twice born. Now, my understanding of that, as for a brahmana, is once they're given the Gayatri, you know, and they do the Upanayanam, then that's the twice born. Nice. And now that they're initiated into the Gayatri Mantra. So if there's another meaning than that, that's probably the most simple meaning. But both the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas, I think, are dvijas, are twice born, I believe, and they're both given the Gayatri at the Upanayanam, the sacred thread. Did you hear something else?
I haven't. I was just curious whether, I mean, when you say, yeah, twice born, if it affects their prarabdha karma, if they get a new, like, almost like a new chart, so to speak,
I don't know if they do. I know that if you take sannyasa, that's true. Mm. If you take sannyasa, then you're starting, your karma is completely cleaned. So you're starting anew. That's why people at the end of their life will often take sannyasa. It just at the end of the, you know, when they're terminal, so to speak, they'll take sannyasa to neutralize any past karmas.
Does that mean all the whole samchitta pool of karma?
No. No, just the karmas you've accrued in this life.
Mm.
You know, it's all wiped out, clean. Mm. Now the samchitta remains. But it also would influence the type of next birth that you have if all the papa karmas are removed, you know. Mm-hmm. And so many brahmanas will take, because they have shraddha in that. There's even a name for it that I can't think of. You know, there's a vividisha, some sannyasa, apat sannyasa. But there's really an end of life sannyasa also. Vidvat sannyasa means for the one who has already is a jnani. Vidvat means they possess knowledge. Right, that vat affix shows possession. So vid means to know. It's a verbal root. So vid itself means knowledge. So vidvat, the one who has knowledge. Vividisha sannyasa, that's a desiderative, the one who desires to have knowledge. So the one who wants to have knowledge is vividisha. So they take sannyasa to live that sannyasa lifestyle because they want to, they're brahmacharis and they want to gain moksha. That's what they want. So they're mumukshus. So they take sannyasa to be able to give up all of their duties within samsara, and just to be able to devote themselves fully to really shravanamana nididhyasana, basically teaching and satsang. That's in chapter 7 of the Panchadashi. You know, teaching and satsang are included. So, the shravana manana nididhyasana, katana, and then sangha, keeping the company of the good, satsanga. Does that answer?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But the. Yeah, that receiving the sacred thread, that upanayana, and the rituals that go along with that, and then being given the Gayatri mantra, which is a very sacred, maybe the most sacred mantra. And as I've understood the meaning over the years, you know, in light of knowledge, that really understand the meaning of the Gayatri, what you're praying for when you pray, do the Gayatri, is that it's Ishwara or Brahman, actually, the one who is self-effulgent through Ishwara Brahman. That your thoughts and feelings and your buddhi, you know, that they come from Bhagawan, they come from the self, as opposed to coming out of jiva srishti. Because usually our thoughts and our feelings and our reactions and all of, they're all there coming out of the kind of the jiva srishti, means the jiva's creation. So you're speaking out of anger, or you're speaking out of depression, or you're speaking out of, you know, a fulfilled desire or something like that. That's the basis of your voice, so to speak. Whereas in the Gayatri, you want your voice and your actions all to be based in coming from the self, from your own being, not from some emotional overload. I'm sorry. That's perfect. It's definitely the mind of a Mahatma. Yeah. And a Dharmanishtha, somebody who's very, very strong in Dharma. They have that antakarna shuddhi relatively, you know. And so that their behavior and their thoughts has Dharma as its base. And then underneath, so to speak, that is the Atma, the self, as your base. Sometimes Ishwara, the manifestation of Ishwara, is a manifestation of Dharma. So Ishwara and Dharma are all often equated as though Dharma is the bones or the order, the infinite order of Ishwara. So is Ishwara in a sense. So then, just another association of that is when you follow that karma yoga buddhi, that Ishwara arpana buddhi, means that your commitment or the way you relate with the world is as a worship of Ishwara. Arpana means worship, so it's a worship of the Lord. But how does that, Swamiji would say something like, well, but how does that operationalize? How do you really do that? It's a commitment to Dharma. That your life is a commitment to Dharma. Commitment to Dharma is a commitment to Ishwara. So that recognition of the relationship between Dharma and Ishwara is important. Because that also then Dharma gains its rightful place in the scheme of things. And you bring it into the Ishwara Arpana Buddhi, you know. Prasada Buddhi also is the other half of that. You see everything, all of the way you respond to the world is responding to always Ishwara. It's It's always as a worship of Ishvara. And the way you receive the karma pala, the results of your actions that come your way, you receive that as prasada, prasada buddhi. You know, so it's Ishvara arpana buddhi and prasada buddhi are very, they're just two sides of the same coin. One is how I act and treat the world, and then how I receive the way the world treats me. It's all Ishvara. And then if you think about it in terms of Dharma, sometimes Swamiji would say, you know, we get what we deserve. This, in the scheme of things, what comes to us is not just coming randomly out of the blue. It's all part of the order, so we can receive it. Receive what comes our way as prasad. And then the ones that are hard to receive, you know, those are good for our sadhana. The easy ones are just Bhagavan. The hard ones are Bhagavan. Let me learn to be able to accommodate these more difficult things.
Well, I wonder if you could talk a bit about forgiveness.
Well, the first thing I'll say about forgiveness is that Swamiji really doesn't like that word. Yeah. He thinks it's as though I have to forgive someone as though they're lesser in a way, that they need your forgiveness. You know, and so he prefers to use the word to understand them. Because if you understand what has caused that person to do that particular behavior, you know, then there's nothing to forgive because you understand. And then another very similar to that, something he talks about, and he has done, and I also give these guided meditations, but they're from Swamiji, really, initially, is that when you say you have a difficult relationship with someone and there's something to forgive, or there's something, there's bad feelings in the relationship, is if you imagine, put yourself sitting, you know, facing each other imaginally, and then you tell that person, just objectively, not with emotion or anger, just objectively how you feel. This is how I feel. This is how our relationship makes me feel. You tell the whole thing, you know, and then that you let them tell the whole thing, how they feel. That's very enlightening, because your psyche actually knows that your psyche has interjected these beings, yourself and the other one, in this relationship. So then that one will tell how they feel, and then you can have the little one inside tell, well, this is how I feel, and this is how I feel. So that gives you some kind of understanding. First of all, it gives some space and understanding. And then, if this can be the same meditation or another one, then if on your side you go back and look at all of the strands of karma, all of the cause and effect, and there's not just going to be one, there's many things that go in, have gone into many cause and effects strands, so to speak, that have gone in from your life that have created this situation that you find yourself in. And you can look at the other person too, the cause and effect that you're aware of that had caused them to be in this situation. And then you look at this situation, this emotional or hurtful situation itself, as a karmapala. Here's, you know, cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect, all of these very complex. It's not just one thing. All these things coming in, and boom, here's the little uncomfortable flower. The fruit of all of that, you know, and then you can offer all of that up to Ishvara, because these difficult things are a product also, you know, just like very happy situations, you can do the same thing, but the karmapala there, that fruit that's been produced between the two of you with all of these different strands, it's not just you and the other, it's many different things coming in, so you just start connecting all those dots and see that resulted in, this is what is produced in Ishvara, Ishvara Srishti, it's a product. You know, and so now you can offer that back to Ishwara and ask him to purify it. Sometimes what we do up at the farm, because we have that river and that nice creek, it's a place where we can sit, and just the noise of the creek is very loud, you know. And so when we do the meditation, we'll offer those difficult things to Ishwara. So you offer one, you just imagine it, what it is, and then you offer it into the stream, Ishwara as the stream, and let Ishwara purify it, and then give it back to you in a different form. See what comes back. It's often surprising, because you're offering the whole thing, let Bhagavan, let the stream purify it, and then let Bhagavan give it back to you as something else. And that something else is usually really, really, really interesting and wonderful. That's a good meditation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm.
We don't have to have that association that Swamiji has, that negative association with forgiveness, but it's good to be aware of that, mm. that there's some sort of an unequal balance there.
Mm.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it can be hard to understand, you know, because that all is based on understanding the other person, and sometimes that's very difficult. And then what's hard about it, I think, is when difficult emotions inside linger and kind of have a grip.
Yeah. Definitely. But we have some good meditations for that. We have some good things. I've got a new one for you. one that you haven't heard before. So, yeah. A surprise. The thing is, these different types of inner work, it's not just one, there's so many, and they just apply them at different times, you know. So it's nice to understand them and spend some time with different ones and feel inside which one you need. Yeah.
The other thing, I think, on a similar topic is that comes up a lot is self-worthiness. How do you develop the feeling that I'm worthy?
You know, that Kohut, who's a famous psychologist, Heinz Kohut, his psychology is called self-psychology. So there's a few psychologists that are very important in our era. He's one of them. And this feeling of lacking in self-worth, not being worthy, and also not being wanted. This is kind of like a little trinity. Not worthy, not feeling really wanted, not really feeling loved. So if you don't feel loved, it isn't for a child. It's not that I'm not, mommy's and daddy don't love me. I don't feel loved. They don't feel like that. They feel unlovable. That's the hurtful thing. You know, they're not loving me right now. I don't feel loved by you, you know. But that's a lot different than saying I'm not lovable. And that feeling of not being lovable is very prevalent in our era. Not feeling lovable, not feeling wanted, not feeling loved, not having self-worth, this whole little package. And one thing, he equates a lot of that to, which I think seems so reasonable to me, lack of mirroring. When you're growing up, there's a certain lack of mirroring. So a little child, especially the first 3-4 years, like Jung will say, you spend your whole life working out the first 4 years.
Alright,
yeah. So we're taking these things so deeply. But like, say when you're expecting a certain response, you're not even, in your mind you're not expecting it. It's not that. Like consciously, I smile and you smile back. You know? So we're not expecting it. It's natural that the feelings I have will be met by the other person, and that will be on the level of the psyche, and the unconscious, the conscious, in the level of your body, the expression of your body, the expression of your face, your eyes, and also the feelings in the psyche, because actually, if they're as though not really that contained in your body, so how, when you meet another person, how you really feel inside is what the other person feels. That's where the real communication takes place. But the way the other person feels also is normally, even without your will, being mirrored by your body, by your body and your face, and your eyes and all that. And so there's this dance that is taking place between you, And if that mirroring, especially imagine between a parent and child, you're a little baby, we're talking an infant, say that mirroring isn't there, it could be totally you're wanting to connect and doing all kinds of little things to make your parent, your mom or your dad, just, come into that dance. But your parent is distracted. And they're not really with you. Their body is there, but their being is not with you. It's off thinking about this and busy and having to do this and so did that. So just lost in that. At the same time, you're bouncing your baby and all of that, but you're not there at all. So there's no mirroring taking place, And so that mirroring, that lack of mirroring, is traumatic for a child, especially if it goes on. If it's a few minutes, then the mom comes back and there they are and everything's fine. But if it's kept up, to some degree, then there's damage, there's trauma that's created by that. They did a study, you may have heard me tell this awful story. I'll tell it again. It's an awful story, but anyway. In the 50s and before, we were inside the psychologists psychological research allowed, it had a wide license that is not allowed anymore. And just like how now we're trying to stop any type of animal experimentation, but until it stopped, it's there. And so that was true psychologically also. And so a mother with her little babies, and the mothers, you can imagine the level of ignorance on the mothers too, thinking that they're doing research and helping with research. They were asked to sit, straight up in a straight back chair with their knees together and the little baby. And I mean a little baby, maybe just a few months old, 6 months old, like that, just a little baby, was there on her knees, right? And so she was told to not, no matter what the baby does, goo goo and trying to get play and all of this with their arms and eyes, and that she was told make no expression, remain expressionless. Okay. And so, at first, that was fine. The baby was just trying to get her attention in this way and that way, and smiling and doing all kinds of things, but nothing was happening. But the mother was not responding at all. And so then it tried a little harder to do it. Still, nothing was happening. And then it started getting very, very upset. Very upset. Now she was still not doing anything until the baby just basically decompensated.
What does it mean, decompensated?
It just fell apart. They get so completely upset. And so that's actually a good thing to understand about how important mirroring is. Of course, we're not doing it perfectly, but we are always coming back to it. And so there's even an adult, Kohut said, mirroring is the oxygen of the soul. That's how important, And so even with us, when we're in relationship with each other and something goes wrong, then there's a break in the mirroring also. And that's very hurtful, very, very uncomfortable, So when these kind of things, because even Winnicott, another famous psychologist for our era, will say, the mothering means fathering, it means the care of the child, has to be good enough. good enough mothering. Because it'll never be perfect, but it's good enough. But to the degree there's been lapses too long, you know, or harsh words because they've got a father who has a bad temper or mother or whatever, that's huge for a little child. You know, it's very, 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 very hurtful. They have to swallow it and take it inside. You know, and so they don't feel, they may feel not lovable, not wanted. This whole Trinity comes, you know. And so with inner child work and some ways that we will be using the imagination will be really, really helpful for that. Imagination, Bhagavan gave us this things like inner child work and different ways of using the imagination, which is, and fantasy, which is incredible, powerful gift that we've been given by reimagining certain things. Like say you have a painful, you imagine that little unlovable girl, and then there's a way to reimagine that, or reimagine the circumstance in which you remember having that feeling. You know, reimagine it, and then imagine this is all for tomorrow and the next days, but anyway, to reimagine it is to change the nama-rupa. In the psyche, the nama-rupa really is the image and the affect. The affect produces the image produces the affect. Affect means that embodied emotion that's held there in the unconscious. So these two are highly connected. So if you change one, you change the other. It's just like the connection between breath, your breath, and the mind. If you calm your mind, you calm your breath. But if you calm your breath, you calm your mind. Because they're connected. You change one, the other changes. So...
can the self-worthiness really be fully restored? Can you think, I mean, if somebody's really quite damaged in that regard?
I think that some things can be absolutely fully restored, but this is the restoration. The type of restoration is a little different. I'm sure you've probably heard this story too, but it's a famous one. One psychologist, actually I forget his name, but he's a psychologist, an Indian psychologist. And he tells the story of in a beautiful palace in one of the main entryways, you know, there are two beautiful vases, china vases that are big, like this, they're big, and they're very, very delicate, very costly, they're special. Too big, they're both absolutely beautiful. One of them had been accidentally knocked over, and because very delicate, it actually went sort of smashed into smithereens on the floor. But these things were so precious and so valuable, they brought in a master to repair it. And so it took him a long time to put all of those pieces together. It's like a very delicate jigsaw puzzle. To put all of those pieces together perfectly, you know. And the end result was that you, with your human eye, you could not tell. They were both perfect. But the one that had never been broken does not have the same experience as the one who has been broken. Even though they're totally put back together. What they've been through, you don't forget. At the same time, you're whole, you know. And so with some of the things that we can do, like with reimagining and things like that, they they transform what had actually happened in your psyche. They transform the memory, actually, in the psyche. But that doesn't mean that you forget what had really happened. You remember what had really happened, but but the memory of it and the affect associated with it is transformed. And so now when you think of that happening, think of what happened, it somehow associates over to the new, the imaginal affect memory, and that's what you feel. But you don't forget this one. We'll do some of those. Those are some of the ones I want to introduce to you. I know they're powerful because I'll tell you the stories that worked on me, actually. Some of my long-term little child stories that, even though I did so much inner child work on them and everything, able to hold them and understand them, they weren't gone. And I don't think the memory will ever be gone, but the affect and the trauma that we hold, the hurt and the pain and the effects that has on your relationships with others, can be transformed. So it's kind of interesting how that works. But I just, you know, Bhagavan is so amazing, you know, that we have these backup systems inside, that things that we can do things. There's ways of healing the psyche. One way to think of it also is all of those memories, they are the fact that you can have memories is Ishwara. What's loading in is Jiva. And so you can be an Ishwara too to that memory in a way. You have some power over the memory. You have some power over how you act or how you act out your feelings. You know. And you can also work on them, that kind of thing. Does that make sense? We have to do some of these things to see what's happening. Mm-hmm. You can also, there's other ways to deal with this lack of self-worth. One of them is, who does have self-worth? When I think of who really has a really strong sense of self-well-being and self-worth, you know. I think of little children in India, when I was in India, so 10 years or so in the 70s, they all were like little, important little people, you know. It was such a nice experience, you know. And they were the center of attention, and what they said definitely mattered, was important, you know. And they knew it. And they walked around like these little three-year-old persons. And that used to just touch my heart, you know. I was thinking of this one family that was very close to Swamiji, and they had two little girls. They're all adults now, their own children and everything. But at that time, there were two little girls, like 2 or 3 years old, that could just, you know, just walk. So she'd dress them up in their little dresses, kind of the same little dresses. And they would, one would be on one side of mom's sari, and the other would be on the other side. They would just be hanging on to the sari, and mother walked along, and the little ducklings were always just right by her side. They were always a threesome, one on each side. Yeah. So secure, you know. So. It's hard for us to have that if we grew up in a more tumultuous family or your parents had anger and all these things. It's hard to have that type of a structure. But you can do a lot to make it fine. Yeah. You have to be the fixed vase, not the one that wasn't hurt. Yeah. in psychology, you know, there's a kind of a value for the wounded healer, because it's it gives you all of the ways that, that you've suffered in your life or been hurt in your life, which everybody has been. And they say this birth on this particular plane, this loka, is, you know, 50-50. It's not as though everything is just wonderful for you. You know, you can write down the beautiful fairy tale of your life, and you can write down the very painful nightmare too, and then just kind of weave them together. Instead of being split, just realize both, you have both sides. You know, something that's very beautiful and something that's a life that's very hard also. You know, so. I was going to say something about that, I forgot.
The wounded healer.
Oh yeah, thanks. Some psychologists will say the wound, Jung included, the wounds that you have, the hurts that you have, are like, they give you empathy. They're not for nothing. They allow you to understand others and others' pain. It would be hard for a person to be a psychologist if they didn't have their own hurts and wounds and done their own work. They had no idea, you know. I remember many years ago, maybe 40, I mean a long time ago, Swamiji asked me, I was just probably sitting with him, giving him tea. We used to take turns giving him morning tea, and he just really seriously asked me, "What is depression?" What happens? I don't think I've ever experienced that. What is it? And I thought, wow. Like, how to explain that? Because students, all of us, I would say, we might not have a clinical depression, but to say that you've never been depressed, that would be very unusual. Very, very unusual. But that was kind of a... So he gained his empathy really through learning, learning from the students. Not that he didn't, I'm sure he had a spectrum of emotions. It's just that he didn't really understand that one, what it was. You know, so he had so much empathy, and he was such a good listener, you know, and always wanted to really understand and wanted to really help. But he had to gain his empathy just through his love for you and wanting to help with that problem. Not that he would know exactly what you're talking about, but he would try to learn what you're talking about. So he had to create his own lines of empathy in some ways. But for most of us, that's not true. We do have all kinds of experiences that allow us, especially if you are able to be with those experiences and work with them and help them, then you can help another person. If you yourself can't face any of that, and those traumas or those hurts inside, then you can't face them in the other person either. You have to be able to face them in yourself to be able to be, you have to be able to be with them in yourself if you can, to be with them in another person. That's why psychologists, people who become psychologists or therapists, at least in the States, you have to be in therapy for a number of years to become a psychologist. Otherwise, you really won't know what it means to work with all of those painful things that you have inside. The good thing is that we can work with them. Yeah. Okay. That it gives a lot more inner space.
This is from the class earlier today. I think you said something like the ignorance, it's not a fault of the mind or something like that?
It's not, the mind didn't create it.
Uh-huh.
It belongs to the mind, but the mind didn't create it. It's beginningless.
Uh-huh.
That's why.
That's
so you can't say, oh, what did I do to deserve this ignorance?
Uh-huh.
What mistake did I make? You know,
uh-huh.
Why do I have it? No, everybody has it. All the mosquitoes have it. All living beings have it. Because of the limitation of the upadi, the body, mind, sense organs, is that is seeking, you know, knowledge, self-knowledge, or whatever, seeking anything, is limited by nature. Like, my mind is different from... The minds are structurally the same, but the content, you know, in terms of just, like, instincts are the same in all of us, but they're used at different times. And the structures of the psyche and the structure of the body, etc., are the same. The blueprint is the same. You know, but then the way that it works is different. That's why we say Maya has two capacities. Vikshepa, the capacity to... Maya Agnanam, you know. Amen. Okay. It has two capacities. Vikshepa, the power to project, and Avarna, the power, capacity to cover. And so for Ishwara, it's all Vikshepa, because infinite, that's what we talked about earlier, infinite projection, not identified with anything. Just the whole is in my consciousness, is known. And I am its being. The me is the self of that infinite creation. But all the parts of the creation, all of the jivas, all of the different living beings in the creation that have a subtle body, sukshma sharira, they're all limited, differentiated one from another, differentiated by time and place and all of these things, quality, you know. And so they have no capacity, the mind has no capacity to know the self, because no means of knowledge. You can be the self, you remain as the self, you know, but no capacity on the part of the mithya mind to perform that viveka that can differentiate the mithya, the mind, from the self. So until one's ready for knowledge, they don't need to. You don't, your sense of self is always taken care of. Wherever you are, you're in that situation, and your situation defines you continually. Your moods define you, your health defines you, your stage in life defines you. You're always, the I is always taken care of by the situation you're in. So you never have to think, who am I? It's continually answered.
Mm-hmm.
But at some points, and they think, well, sometimes this is who I am, but I'm never, you know, I'm never a sister to my... I'm never a sister to my mother, you know. And I'm never, you know, whatever the situation is, or whatever the relationship is with that person or those people, not with these people. So the I, if you start to analyze it, then you'll come with a question kind of like, well, who is the one who is with all of these people? Or who is the one that is there for all of these different situations? You know? Because that one can't be defined by any given situation, because the situations all change. So who's the constant there? Who am I really? The one who is in all of these situations. So there's not much you can do about that. I mean, the logic on that is pretty tight. What can you say? You know.
I believe you said before that we can see Ishvara as an infinite mind. Did you say that?
Oh yeah. What I said is you can. Ishvara. When I say, sometimes I use as an illustration.
Yeah.
That you can think of Ishwara as an infinite mind, or like an infinite mind. Because in reference to your mind, every thought that you have, the entire thought, whatever it is that's come to consciousness, that is known. It's not that, say you have a thought, even I'm looking out at all of you and I'm seeing this whole room and everybody's sitting here and there's little Shiva and I'm seeing everything here, right? But my mind doesn't lock on to one thing as me. Right? And not at all, right? But, you know, if you're a jiva, like the people in the room, that from my standpoint, I'm as Ishvara, this is all one, this is all myself. This is a projection of my being, a projection of my maya. But then all the living beings within the projection of my maya, and I'm not identified with any given part of it, you know, saying, well, I'm a conscious being. Where in fact, everybody in the room and the walls and the ceilings and the whole thing is only me, and the conscious being is really the common denominator of everyone's experience, the one conscious me, the consciousness which is me. You know? So now I would say, if I'm talking about now myself in reference to this vision, I am as likening it to the Ishvara, because I'm not identified with any given part in this vision, and yet all of it exists in me. So this is, that I have this vision at all is because I have sense organs and I have a mind, I have a vritti, a thought modification. So this thought modification enjoys one conscious being, oneself. So you can say it's like for Ishvara, just imagine it like the infinite creation, the whole thing is known. So it's like an infinite mind because the mind is sattva. And so that means the mind manifests or reflects consciousness. And so if you look at the whole creation as being a display of sattva, rajas, and tamas, where sattva is the part of maya that reflects as though reflects consciousness, and rajas is what's responsible for all movement, all activity, and tamas is what's responsible for really nama rupa. You know, if you see the whole creation as a expression of these three principles, then rajas is everywhere, tamas is everywhere, and sattva is everywhere. You know, so we see nama rupa, we see tamas, these nama rupas, but if we were to go into them, we see that there's so much rajas there. There's so much activity there. It looks all stable and everything. It's not stable at all. There's a continual display of infinite activity on every level, going bigger and bigger and smaller and smaller. There's also, you know, what we're discovering as we research and go into it, we see everything's energy, but we also see this on another level, it's name and form, but inside is just nothing but energy. So there's rajas, there's tamas, and all of it is known. There's sattva. And so say if you see sattva going through the entire creation as rajas and tamas does, then the whole creation reflects consciousness. Like your mind reflects consciousness, the whole creation reflects consciousness. So that's why you can say Ishvara is like an infinite mind. Then you can go and look at how your mind, you can't have a thought that doesn't reflect consciousness. You just make it an infinite thought. Makes sense?
Yeah, it's just that it was a little bit itchy with the mind, like infinite mind, like there was a knower or was not. So.
Yeah, but the thing is, even for you, for me, there is no knower. There's only that's only linguistic in a way. There's no knower, there's known. So wherever there's sattva is, whatever is, because of the sense organs in the mind, whatever is contained in the sattva, that is known. The self is known, the mind is known, the sense organs are known, the body is known, the world is known. You go inward or outward. The fact is that there is no knower, there's only known. And we attribute knower, knowing, known to our experience here, because I am the knower and you are the known. So what about me as the knower in this vritti? me, the conscious being, is the vritti, and I call that the knower. I am the conscious being, and you who are in the vritti are the known. And then I have the problem of what we call upadis, where I'm confused about that knower-known dichotomy. Because I have to in the end, I have to recognize this body is known, the sense organs are known, this trikdrisha, seer, seeing, viveka. I have to see that. Thus I just take, you know, I'm the knower. This person here. We have to realize that, okay, this person here is the knower, except your body is known, isn't it? Of course it's known. Well, who's knowing it? Well, my sense organs are knowing it. Do you know your sense organs? Well, of course I know my sense organs. I know if they're working or not. So this ultimate knowership is continually made into the known also. It does, performs a function like an instrument, but it's also known. And that knownness is only going to resolve in the Atma, because the Atma is also known as Swaprakasha, self-luminous, self-evident. Self-evident knownness. Yeah. The knowership, he is so cute. Anyway, I don't remember what I said. Anybody?
I was thinking about the question that Sana asked about the worthiness.
Yeah.
And I think I've heard you said before that it's the not knowing yourself that creates the also the unworthiness, because I see that, I mean, we also have this human mind that also compares and can see that that's better, maybe better, and
yeah,
that's bigger and that's more beautiful, and that this comparing and judging mind.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I sometimes feel that maybe it's really, really hard to feel this complete worthiness if you don't
yes,
deeper, I mean, where does the love come from and that part?
Yeah, I think that's right. There's our experiences within samsara are all relative.
Mm.
Even the happiness is relative, the worthiness, the being lovable. But the thing is that, like when Winnicott says, good enough mothering, you have good enough worth,
yeah,
good enough feeling worthy. So that's not something that bothers you. It's not that you feel worthy all the time. But that structure is solid, you know. But it's not, there's nothing changeless and absolute in our experience. But it can be good enough so that it's not debilitating. You know, it's just the natural plight of being a human being.
Yeah.
And it's also humbling in a positive way to kind of realize that you're not perfect and you always make mistakes. And then we just do our best to do our best. But this illusion that we can be perfect also can create, if we feel that we should have reach some level of perfection, then when we continue not to reach that or be as perfect as we would like to be, you can get complexes around it unless you realize that that's part of being human, you know. So it's not about being worthy or unworthy. So that's also a good kind of manana, or what do you call that? Reflection, self-reflection, to see what it is that's unworthy, that feels, could be probably a little girl inside, unworthy and unworthy of love, unlovable. I think unworthy and unlovable often are associated, because if you're really lovable but then you're unworthy, then who cares? I'll do my best, that's all, but I'm lovable.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Even if you don't use those words, like if you're a poor, have a lot of trauma and you had that the narcissistic wound, you have a shield that protects you from the pain, and that you feel that you're, everybody loves you, and if they don't, they have to leave immediately. These are all traumas, problems. Time for bed. Right, it's time. 7 o'clock.
Om swasti prajapyah paripalayantam. Nyayena margena mahim mahishaha ko brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamsho bharahitah brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma satkamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari